I'd like to share with you a few words from an essay on our fifth principle written by the Reverend Earl Holt. It may seem surprising to find a stated commitment to democratic method or process among the core purposes of a religious organization, but perhaps less so if one remembers that Unitarian Universalism is based on two religions born in the New World in the formative years of the American Republic, each of them decisively influenced and shaped in their formative years by the same Enlightenment ideas and values that gave rise to the American Revolution and American democracy. It is no accident that so many of the founders of the Republic were also leaders in the formation of these American denominations, including, among others, Benjamin Rush, Universalist and signer of the Declaration of Independence, and Joseph Priestley, the scientist and Unitarian preacher who was a strong influence on Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. Their religious convictions were crucial in their formulation of America's political creed. For as James Madison would say later, "What is a government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature?" Political and religious ideas interpenetrate. For example, the political notion that that people have a right to self-government grows out of a religious conviction that human beings have the capacity to shape their own destiny, that they are not mere puppets on a divine string. Democracy, to put it another way, is more than a mechanism of governance. It is an expression of faith in the power of human beings to shape their own lives, a faith that is most explicit in the ideals of our religious tradition. I want to begin this sermon by once again welcoming those who have joined our church this morning. Everyone, member or not, is welcome to our worship and to all the programs we offer. Everyone, member or not, will be served by our community when they are in time of need. But you, now as members, join the ranks of those who have the right to be a full participant in this democratically run institution. You now have the right to vote for those who will lead our church and serve as chairs of many committees. You have the right not only to vote on those who will represent you, but also to vote directly upon many major issues that affect this congregation. That does not happen in most churches. Most churches are not democratically run as we are. And truth be told, this democracy of ours can sometimes be a bit cumbersome, time-consuming, and sometimes even a little messy. At a meeting with some of my Unitarian Universalist ministerial colleagues not long ago, someone said, "Wouldn't it be great just to be an Episcopal priest for a day or two, now and then, so you could straighten out those things that get bogged down in the process?" And I have to admit, there has been times when that might have sounded tempting. But the truth is, not one of us would ever opt for a system of congregational decision-making that was anything other than democratic. Our reasons for supporting the use of the democratic process in our churches is not because it is more expedient. The reasons we value the democratic process is not practical or even political. It is actually theological. We, as a faith tradition, believe in this process because it is the manifestation of an even more fundamental belief. That is our belief in the equal worth and dignity of every person, the belief that everyone's voice is important, not just the voice of the rich or the powerful. For the last several weeks, I've spent Wednesday evenings with about 10 of our newcomers at our church in the New to UU classes, and together we've explored lots of things, including the historical journey of the free church. And it is a theological journey that has moved away from the belief and the divine predetermined plan where every human action was preset by God, to a view where human beings have free choice to determine their own path, A view that says we all have the capacity to shape our lives and our world. This view of nature, along with the acknowledgement that we all have the same inherent dignity and worth, and that we are committed to equality, requires that democracy be a fundamental principle of the free church. This inclusion of the democratic process as one of our fundamental religious principles often comes as a surprise to folks new to our tradition. But if we remember a bit about both our Unitarian and Universalist history, as that essay from Earl Holt pointed out, recalling that we emerged at the same time and were shaped by the same influences as our nation, it makes sense. Leaders like Benjamin Rush, as you heard, who was a Universalist who signed the Declaration of Independence, and Unitarians like Jefferson and Adams had fundamental ideas that were inherently both political and religious at the same time. The Reverend Earl Holt, in the portion of that essay I shared with you this morning, used a really interesting word. I didn't even know it was a word until I read that essay, and I'm trusting it is. But the word is interpenetrate. He described the relationships of the political and religious ideas as ones that interpenetrate. The famous 20th century Unitarian minister A. Powell Davies said that democracy was in fact a social and political expression of a religious principle. So yes, as a religious tradition, we affirm and promote the use of the democratic process. But that's only the beginning of the discussion. We do not affirm and promote the democratic process to the exclusion of all other principles. It does not and it should not stand alone as we approach issues in our society or in our church. It is not our only principle. And if it were, we would be in serious trouble. Both our church and our government have to be more than just the expression of the view of a majority of the people. The democratic process, like any kind of governance, has its weaknesses and is subject to abuse. You probably all know the famous Winston Churchill line that says, democracy is the worst form of government except for the others. Raw, self-interested, every person for themselves democracy will not produce justice and will not move us forward either as an institution or as a nation. As the great social justice preacher from Riverside Church in New York, William Sloan Coffin, put it, democracy does not guarantee that virtue will be exercised. And in the history of our nation, there are many sad periods where the democratic process was used to institute and to maintain injustice. We need only look at our history of segregation, racism, slavery, to see how the majority speaking through the democratic process can be very unjust. It is exactly because the democratic process has this potential negative side that it's only half of our fifth principle. That fifth principle reads in its entirety, we affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large. It's only by pairing a well-developed conscience with the use of the democratic process that we are able to make decisions that go beyond our small self-interest. It's only when conscience is combined with the democratic process that we make decisions that are generous, loving, and wise. It is conscience that can keep us from abusing the democratic process. And indeed, it is also the role of religion to bring conscience to the democratic process. You know, it seems to me that this generous kind of democracy, the democracy that's guided not by self-interest but by conscience, takes into account the interests of others. That kind of democracy, it seems to me it's having a tough time. Right now, as I look at our country, I have concerns about how democracy is working. In fact, I even have concerns for the future of democracy. Let me start with the right to vote itself. This week in Selma, Alabama, on the 47th anniversary of the famous Civil Rights March there, there was another march to protest the increasing denial of the right to vote to many individuals today. Over the last several years, about 15 state legislatures have passed some form of voter ID law, which is having the effect of preventing many qualified people from voting, and bills are presently pending in 24 other state legislatures to do the same. Perhaps you saw, as I did on the news this week, the story of an 86-year-old veteran from Ohio. He'd hired a driver, because he could no longer drive, to take him to the polling place so he could vote. He brought a photo ID issued by the Veterans Administration. It was the only photo ID he had because his driver's license had expired and he was not able to renew it because he was no longer able to drive. The veteran's ID had his photo and his name on it, but it did not have his address. He was turned away and denied the right to perform the civic duty he had been as proud to perform for his entire adult life at this place as he had been proud to serve his country in World War II. New laws make it difficult for the poor, the elderly, and students to participate in the democratic process in states all over our nation. State legislatures argue that this is an attempt to prevent voter fraud. But when questioned what fraud there has been, they have little to point to. In fact, almost every study done indicates that there is very little voter fraud. Their unsupported reason for passing these laws seems to be a cover to deny the vote to certain people. It's hard to believe that nearly 50 years after the first march in Selma, people have to march again for the basic right to vote. Making it difficult for any group of people to vote, whether it's liberals doing it to conservatives or conservatives doing it to liberals, is certainly a threat to democracy. It is obvious that there is an agenda which has nothing to do with the prevention of fraud behind these initiatives. And we morally cannot turn a blind eye because so far we are not the ones for whom exercising our right to vote has been made difficult or even impossible. But you know, as serious as this threat is, these attempts to limit the rights of some to vote pale in terms of the negative impact they have on the democratic process when compared to another threat to democracy. I want to be very clear that this other threat to democracy, which I believe to be the greatest threat to its future, is not a concern with one political party or perspective, but with what's happening in both parties and among both liberals and conservatives. This concern goes to the very heart of the functioning of the democratic process. In my opinion, is a moral question of the highest order upon which all religions in this country should be speaking out. At the beginning of this sermon, we sang that great hymn that begins, "Once to every soul and nation comes the moment to decide in the strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side." The words to that hymn come from a James Russell Lowell poem entitled, "The Present Crisis." And they remind us that there are critical moments when we are called to stand boldly for what is right. And I believe that we are either at or near one of those moments right now with respect to the functioning of the democratic process in our country. Particularly since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, but also long before, money has been the name of the game in politics. From the incredible amount of money spent lobbying Congress to the donations of millions of dollars by single individuals to PACs, which essentially fund the campaigns of those running for the highest office in the land, it seems pretty obvious that government is for sale. It is impossible for me to believe that any politician, liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, can directly or indirectly accept this kind of money and not feel obligated to advance and support the agenda of the donor. I know what's happening here is not illegal, but I'm reminded of a biblical line from the 10th chapter of the first book of Corinthians, and it keeps coming back to me, and it says this: all these things are lawful, but not all lawful things are helpful. Not all lawful things serve to build us up as a society. For the most part, the money in the system is technically legal, but I think it's not morally right. It's not helpful in building up the future of a strong democracy. Many have called, in fact, what's going on in our government today legal bribery. You know, many of you know that I often go to Mexico, and you're probably aware that there's a lot of corruption in Mexico. And although it's sometimes not seen that way by some Mexicans, what amounts to bribery is pretty common. You know, to get a permit to build a house or add on to a house, you often have to grease the hands of the official with a bit of cash. If you get stopped by the police, you often need a bit of cash to resolve the situations to keep you out of jail. It's not right. Many of my friends who live in Mexico debate whether they should participate in this corruption, but most always carry a bit of extra cash just in case. In fairness to Mexico, I understand that things are getting better in regards to officials accepting bribes. But you know, you don't have to go to Mexico to see this happening. Many years ago, I was stopped driving through the state of Georgia at night. I was naive. I didn't realize if you had a Massachusetts license plate and were driving through Georgia at night, that was reason enough to stop you. I was going through an area where you might remember, if you drove to Florida years ago, where Route 95 was incomplete, so you had to go off on local roads for a while. I had done nothing wrong. In fact, I was being extra careful. But nonetheless, I was stopped by the police. The officer gave me some story about one of my lights being out, which I could see was not true, and going a little fast, which I was sure was not true, and then said something like, well, we could either resolve this now, or we could go into town and wait to go before the judge in the morning. He wanted a bribe. My blood was boiling. But there were calmer heads in the car with me. And someone took out a couple of $20 bills, gave them to him, and we were off on our way. That incident and what happens in Mexico sometimes are wrong. But as I think about them, I think they actually pale and scale to what's happening on the campaign trails and in the halls of government in our country every day. Legal or illegal, the infusion of huge amounts of money by wealthy individuals and special interests is wrong, morally wrong, because it is a fundamental attack on the equality of each person before their government. It nullifies our right to select leaders through a truly democratic process who will act in the collective best interests of all of us. It seems to me that somehow we need to get money out of politics. If we could, I think we would have a very different government, one where the people's representatives actually had what's in the best interest of everyone in their hearts. Where true and honest discussion and debate about what's right for our nation could actually take place. I don't think small fixes in campaign finance laws or disclosure laws are going to do it. I believe we need a total reform package, probably some kind of system of publicly funded campaigns for all offices, where the government gives to qualified candidates not only funds, but generous amounts of television and radio time to use as the candidate wishes to get his or her message out. Many say that in light of the Supreme Court's recent decisions, it would probably require a constitutional amendment to do this, and we know that wouldn't be an easy thing to do. I'm not here this morning to propose a worked-out political solution. That is not the role of religion, even one that affirms the use of the democratic process as one of its foundational principles, as we do. My message is, and the role of religion should be, to point out what are serious and pressing moral threats to democracy. You know, in that famous Gettysburg Address, Lincoln ended it with the line, "The government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." I worry, in fact, that it could perish if we continue as we are. I think we are on a road that is leading us to a government that is not of, or by, or for the people. I know that these are strong words that I preach today. This moral issue has been eating at me for some time. And more, I think that we are unlikely to address any really significant issues in our country until we address this one. What I ask of you this morning is that you think about this issue for yourself. Bring your values to test what's going on. And if you believe as I do, that the more that the democratic process leaves people out, the more the process is taken over by a small, wealthy group of people with strong special interests, the less government will work in the best interests of all people. If you believe that, then we need to find ways to share that understanding with others and to work with others to a day where some reform in the system can come about and the future of democracy can again be a bright one.